The princess was pleased and triumphantly said to her husband, "You see, I was right." When Vronsky appeared, she was still more pleased and was strengthened in her opinion that Kitty ought to make not only a good, but a brilliant match. In the mother's eyes, there was no comparison between Levin and Vronsky. She did not like Levin's strange and harsh criticisms, his awkward manner in society, which she attributed to pride, and what she considered his strange way of life in the country, occupied with cattle and peasants. In particular, she did not like the fact that when he was in love with her daughter, he came to the house for 6 weeks as if waiting and looking out for something, afraid of doing them too great an honour by making an offer of marriage, and that he did not understand that if he visited at a house where there was a marriageable girl, he ought to declare his intentions. And then, suddenly, he left without proposing. "It is a good thing he is so unattractive and that Kitty has not fallen in love with him," thought her mother. Vronsky satisfied all the mother's desires. He was very rich, clever, distinguished, with a brilliant military career before him, a position at court, and altogether was an enchanting man. Nothing better could be desired. Vronsky was openly attentive to Kitty when they met at balls, danced with her, and came to the house, so there could be no doubt as to the seriousness of his intentions. But in spite of this, the mother was in a dreadful state of anxiety and agitation all that winter. When the princess herself had married, more than 30 years before, the match had been arranged by an aunt. Her fiancé, about whom everything was known beforehand, came, saw his intended bride, and was seen by her people. Then the matchmaking aunt learnt what was thought on each side, and passed on the information. All was satisfactory. Afterwards, at an appointed time and place, the expected proposal was made to and accepted by her parents. Everything was done very easily and simply. At least, so it seemed to the princess. But in her daughter's case, she experienced how far from easy and simple the apparently easy business of marrying off a daughter really was. What anxiety she had to suffer! How many questions to consider over and over again! How much money to spend! How many encounters with her husband to go through when her two elder daughters, Daria and Natalie, were married. Now that her youngest daughter had come out, she was living through the same fears and doubts, and having even worse disputes with her husband than on her elder daughter's account. Like all fathers, the old prince was extremely punctilious where his daughter's purity and honour were concerned. He was unreasonably jealous, especially about Kitty, his favourite, and at every step reproached the princess with compromising her daughter. The princess had grown used to this in respect to her elder daughters, but now she felt that her husband's punctiliousness had more justification. She could see that lately social customs had changed very much, and a mother's duties had become still more difficult. She knew that girls of Kitty's age formed societies of some sort, went to courses of lectures, made friends freely with men, and drove alone through the streets. Many no longer curtsied, and above all, every one of them was firmly convinced that the choice of a husband was her own and not her parents' business. "Nowadays they don't give us away in marriage as they used to," said these young girls, and even the old people said the same. But how marriages are now arranged, the princess could not find out from anyone. The French way of parents deciding a daughter's fate was not accepted, and was even condemned. The English way of giving a girl perfect freedom was also rejected, and would have been impossible in Russian society. The Russian way of employing a professional matchmaker was considered monstrous and was laughed at by everybody, including the princess herself. But how a girl was to get married, or how a mother was to get a daughter given in marriage, no one knew. Everyone with whom the princess discussed the subject said the same thing. "Well, you know, in our days it is time to give up obsolete customs. After all, it's the young people who marry, and not their parents. Therefore they must be left to arrange matters as they think best." It was all very well for people who had no daughters to talk like that, but the princess knew that intimacy might be followed by love, and that her daughter might fall in love with someone who had no intention of marrying or was not fit to be her husband. And whatever people might say about the time having come when young people must arrange their future for themselves, she could not believe it any more than she could believe that loaded pistols could ever be the best toys for 5-year-old children. That is why the princess was more anxious about Kitty than she had been about her elder daughters. And now she was afraid that Vronsky might content himself with merely flirting with her daughter. She saw that Kitty was in love with him, but consoled herself with the thought that Vronsky was an honest man and therefore would not act in such a way. At the same time, she knew that the freedom now permitted made it easy for a man to turn a girl's head, and knew how lightly men regarded an offence of that kind. The week before, Kitty had repeated to her mother a conversation she had had with Vronsky while dancing the mazurka with him. This conversation had partly reassured the princess, but she could not feel quite at ease. Vronsky had told Kitty that he and his brother were so used to comply with their mother's wishes that they never made up their minds to take an important step without consulting her. "And I am now especially happy looking forward to my mother's arrival from Petersburg," he had said. Kitty had narrated this without attaching any special meaning to the words, but to her mother they appeared in a different light. She knew that the old lady was expected any day, and would approve of her son's choice, and though she thought it strange that he should delay proposing for fear of hurting his mother, she so desired the marriage, and especially relief from her own anxiety, that she believed it. Hard as it was to see the misfortune of Dolly, her eldest daughter, who thought of leaving her husband, the princess's anxiety as to her youngest daughter's fate, now about to be decided, entirely absorbed her. Lievin's arrival that day gave her further cause for anxiety. She was afraid that her daughter, who had once seemed to have a certain affection for Lievin, might be led by an exaggerated feeling of loyalty to reject Vronsky, and she feared that in general Lievin's arrival might cause complications and delays in matters now so near conclusion. "Has he been back long?" asked the princess when they got home, referring to Lievin.
"He arrived today, Mama." "There is one thing I want to say," the princess began, and from her serious look Kitty guessed what was coming.
"Mama," she said, flushing and turning quickly toward her mother,
"please, please say nothing about it. I know. I know quite well."
Her wish was the same as her mother's, but the motive underlying her mother's wish offended her.
"I wish to say that having given hopes to one—"
"Mama, dearest, for heaven's sake, don't speak. It is so dreadful to speak about it."
"I won't. Only this, my darling," said the mother, seeing tears in her daughter's eyes. "You promised not to have any secrets from me, and you won't, will you?"
"Never, Mama. Never at all," answered Kitty, blushing, as she looked her mother straight in the face.
"But I have nothing to say at present. If I wished to, I should not know what to say or how. I don't know."
No, she could not possibly tell an untruth with such eyes, thought the mother, smiling at her agitation and joy. The princess smiled to think how immense and important what was going on in her own soul must appear to the poor girl.
Chapter 13.
During the interval between dinner and the beginning of the evening party, Kitty experienced something resembling a young man's feelings before a battle. Her heart was beating violently, and she could not fix her thoughts on anything. She felt that this evening, when those two men were to meet for the first time, would decide her fate, and she kept picturing them to herself, now individually and now together. When she thought of the past, she dwelt with pleasure and tenderness on her former relations with Lievin. Memories of childhood and of Lievin's friendship with her dead brother lent a peculiar poetic charm to her relations with him. His love for her, of which she felt sure, flattered and rejoiced her, and she could think of him with a light heart.
With her thought of Vronsky was mingled some uneasiness, though he was an extremely well-bred and quiet-mannered man. A sense of something false, not in him, for he was very simple and kindly, but in herself. Whereas in relation to Levin, she felt herself quite simple and clear. On the other hand, when she pictured to herself a future with Vronsky, a brilliant vision of happiness rose up before her, while a future with Levin appeared wrapped in mist. On going upstairs to dress for the evening and looking in the glass, she noticed with pleasure that this was one of her best days and that she was in full possession of all her forces, which would be so much wanted for what lay before her. She was conscious of external calmness and of freedom and grace in her movements. At 7:30, as soon as she had come down into the drawing-room, the footman announced, "Konstantin Dmitrich Levin." The princess was still in her bedroom, nor had the prince yet come down. "So it's to be," thought Kitty, and the blood rushed to her heart. Glancing at the mirror, she was horrified at her pallor. She felt sure that he had come so early on purpose to see her alone and to propose to her. And now, for the first time, the matter presented itself to her in a different and entirely new light. Only now did she realize that this matter, with whom she would be happy, who was the man she loved, did not concern herself alone, but that in a moment she would have to wound a man she cared for, and to wound him cruelly. Why? Because the dear fellow was in love with her. But it could not be helped. It was necessary and had to be done. "Oh, God, must I tell him so myself?" she thought. "Must I really tell him that I don't care for him? That would not be true. What then shall I say? Shall I say that I love another? No, that's impossible. I'll go away. Yes, I will." She was already approaching the door when she heard his step. No, it would be dishonest. What have I to fear? I've done nothing wrong. I'll tell the truth, come what may. Besides, it's impossible to feel awkward with him. "Here he is," she thought, as she saw his powerful, diffident figure before her and his shining eyes gazing at her. She looked straight into his face as if entreating him to spare her, and gave him her hand. "I don't think I've come at the right time. I'm too early," he said, gazing round the empty drawing-room. When he saw that his expectation was fulfilled and that nothing prevented his speaking to her, his face clouded over. "Not at all," said Kitty, and sat down at the table. "But all I wanted was to find you alone," he began, still standing and avoiding her face so as not to lose courage. "Mama will be down in a minute. She was so tired yesterday." She spoke without knowing what she was saying, her eyes fixed on him with a caressing look full of entreaty. He glanced at her. She blushed and was silent. "I told you that I did not know how long I should stay, that it depends on you." Her head dropped lower and lower, knowing the answer she would give to what was coming. "That it would depend on you," he repeated. I want to say, I came on purpose that, to be my wife," he uttered, hardly knowing what he said, but feeling that the worst was out, he stopped and looked at her. She was breathing heavily and not looking at him. She was filled with rapture. Her soul was overflowing with happiness. She had not at all expected that his declaration of love would make so strong an impression on her. But that lasted only for an instant. She remembered Vronsky, lifted her clear, truthful eyes to Levin's face, and noticing his despair, she replied quickly, "It cannot be. Forgive me." How near to him she had been a minute ago, how important in his life, and how estranged and distant she seemed now.
"Nothing else was possible," he said without looking at her, and bowing, he turned to go.
Chapter 14. But just at that moment the princess came in. An expression of terror appeared in her face on seeing them alone together and noticing their troubled looks. Levin bowed to her and said nothing. Kitty sat with downcast eyes. "Thank heaven she has refused him," thought the mother, and her face brightened into the usual smile with which she greeted her visitors on Thursday evenings. She sat down and began questioning Levin about his life in the country. He too sat down until the arrival of other guests should enable him to get away unnoticed. 5 minutes later, Kitty's friend, the Countess Nordston, who had married the year before, came in. She was a thin, sallow, nervous, ailing woman with shining black eyes. She was fond of Kitty, and her affection showed itself as the affection of a married woman for an unmarried one generally does, in a desire to get Kitty married according to her, the Countess's, own ideal of conjugal bliss, and she wished to see her married to Vronsky. She always disliked Levin, whom at the beginning of the winter she had often met at the Shcherbatskys'. Her constant and favourite amusement was to make fun of him. "I love it when he looks down at me from the height of his dignity, or breaks off his clever conversation because I am too stupid, or when he shows his condescension toward me. I do love it, his condescension. I'm very glad he hates me," she used to say with reference to him. She was right, because Levin really could not bear her, and despised her for the very thing she was proud of and regarded as a merit, that is, her nervousness and refined contempt and disregard for all the rough and common things of life. Between the Countess Nordston and Levin, relations had grown up such as are not infrequently met with in society, when two people outwardly remaining in friendly relations despise each other to such an extent that they cannot treat each other seriously, or even be offended with one another. The Countess at once attacked Levin. "Ah, Mr. Levin, so you have returned to our depraved Babylon," she said, holding out her tiny yellow hand, and repeating the words he had used early in the winter when he had called Moscow Babylon. "Has Babylon improved? Or have you deteriorated?" she added, and turned toward Kitty with a sarcastic smile.
"I am much flattered that you remember my words so well, Countess," replied Levin, who had had time to recover his self-possession, resuming immediately and by force of habit his banteringly hostile relation with her. "They evidently produced a strong impression on you."
"Why, of course, I always write them down.
Well, Kitty, have you been skating again?"
She began to talk with Kitty. Awkward as it would have been for Levin to leave just then, he would have preferred doing so to remaining in the house for the rest of the evening in sight of Kitty, who now and then glanced at him but avoided catching his eye. He was about to rise when the princess, noticing his silence, turned toward him and said, "Have you come to Moscow for long? But I believe you are on the Zemstvo and cannot stay away long."
"No, Princess, I am no longer on the Zemstvo," he answered. "I have come to Moscow for a few days."
"Something out of the common has happened to him," thought the Countess Nordston, scrutinizing his stern and serious face. "Why does he not start on one of his discourses? But I'll draw him out. I do love to make a fool of him when Kitty's about, and I will." "Mr. Levin," she began, "explain to me, please, you who know everything, how it is that at our Kaluga estate the peasant men and women have drunk everything they had and never pay anything they owe us. What is the explanation? You always praise the peasants so much."
At that moment another lady entered the room, and Levin rose. "Excuse me, Countess, but really I know nothing about it and can't tell you anything," he said. And as he turned, he saw an officer who had come into the room behind the lady. "That must be Vronsky," he thought, and looked at Kitty to make sure. She had already glanced at Vronsky and then turned toward Levin. And by the look of her eyes, which had involuntarily brightened, Levin realized that she loved this man, realized it as surely as if she had told it him in so many words. But what kind of man was he? Now, rightly or wrongly, Levin could not but remain. He had to find out what sort of a man it was that she loved. There are people who, when they meet a rival, no matter in what, at once shut their eyes to everything good in him and see only the bad. There are others who, on the contrary, try to discern in a lucky rival the qualities which have enabled him to succeed, and with aching hearts seek only the good in him. Levin belonged to the latter sort. But it was not difficult for him to see what was good and attractive in Vronsky. It struck him immediately. Vronsky was a dark, sturdily built man of medium height, with a good-natured, handsome, exceedingly quiet and firm face. Everything about his face and figure, from his black, closely cropped hair and freshly shaven chin to his wide, brand-new uniform, was simple and at the same time elegant. Having stepped aside to let a lady pass, Vronsky approached first the princess and then Kitty. When he moved toward her, his fine eyes brightened with a special tenderness, and carefully and respectfully bending over her with a scarcely perceptible, happy, and, as it seemed to Levin, modestly triumphant smile, he held out to her his small, broad hand. Having greeted and spoken a few words to everyone else, he sat down without having once looked at Levin, who had not taken his eyes off him. "Let me introduce you," said the princess, indicating Levin. "Konstantin Dmitrich Levin, Count Alexis Kirillovich Vronsky." Vronsky rose and, looking cordially into Levin's eyes, pressed his hand. "I was to have dined with you earlier this winter," he said with his simple, frank smile, "but you unexpectedly went away to the country."
"Mr. Levin despises and hates the town and us townspeople," said Countess Nordston.
"My words must make a deep impression on you for you to remember them so long," said Levin. Then, recollecting that he had said this before, he blushed. Vronsky glanced at him and at the Countess and smiled. "And you always live in the country?" he asked. "Isn't it dull in the winter?" "No, not when one is busy. Nor need one be dull in one's own company," replied Levin abruptly. "I'm fond of the country," said Vronsky, noticing but pretending not to notice Levin's tone.
"But I hope, Count, you would not consent always to live in the country," said the Countess Nordston.
"I don't know. I've never tried it for long. I have experienced a curious feeling," he went on. "Nowhere have I felt so homesick for the country, our Russian country, with its peasants in bark shoes, as when I spent a winter with my mother in Nice. Nice in itself is dull, you know. And Naples and Sorrento are pleasant only for a short stay, and it is there that one thinks of Russia and longs, especially for the Russian countryside. They seem to..." He was addressing both Kitty and Levin, his quiet and friendly glance passing from the one to the other. He was evidently speaking quite sincerely and frankly. Noticing that the Countess Nordston wished to say something, he stopped without finishing what he was saying and listened attentively to her. The conversation did not flag for a moment, so that the old princess, who always had in reserve, in case of need, two heavy guns, classical versus modern education and general conscription, had no need to bring them forward, and the Countess Nordston had no opportunity to tease Levin. Levin wished to join in the general conversation, but found it impossible, and kept saying to himself, "Now I will go," yet he did not go, but waited for something indefinite. The conversation touched on table-turning and spiritualism, and the Countess Nordston, who believed in spiritualism, began relating miracles she had witnessed.
"Ah, Countess, you must really take me there. For goodness sake, take me to them. I have never seen anything supernatural, though I always look out for it,"
said Vronsky, smiling. "Very well, next Saturday," replied the Countess Nordston. "And you, Mr. Levin? Do you believe in it?" she asked, turning to him.
"Why do you ask me? You know very well what I shall say."
"But I want to hear your opinion."
"My opinion is that this table-turning proves that our so-called educated class is on the same level as the peasants. They believe in the evil eye and spells and witchcraft, while we—"
"Well, then, you don't believe."
"I can't believe, Countess."
"But if I have seen it myself?"
"The peasant women tell how they've seen the goblins with their own eyes."
"Then you think I am not telling the truth?"
And she laughed mirthlessly.
"Oh, no, Masha, Mr. Levin only says he can't believe," said Kitty, blushing for Levin.
And Levin, understanding this, became still more irritated and wished to answer. But Vronsky, with his bright and frank smile, came at once to the rescue of the conversation, which was threatening to become unpleasant. "You don't admit that it is even possible?" he asked. "But why not? We admit the existence of electricity, which we don't understand. Why can't there be other forces which we do not yet know, but which—" "When electricity was first discovered," Levin hurriedly interrupted, "only the phenomena were observed. Their cause and its effects were unknown. Centuries passed before anyone thought of applying it. But the spiritualists, on the contrary, began by the tables writing for them and the spirits coming to them, and they only afterwards began to say that it was an unknown force." Vronsky listened attentively to Levin, as he always listened, evidently interested in what he was saying. "Yes, but the spiritualists say, we do not yet know what force it is, but it exists, and these are the conditions under which it acts. Or let the scientists discover what the force is." "No, I do not see why it should not be a new force if it—" "For this reason," Levin again interrupted him, "that with electricity you need only rub a piece of resin against wool, and you will always produce a certain phenomenon. But this other does not always act, so it is not a natural force." Probably feeling that the conversation was becoming too serious for a drawing-room, Vronsky did not reply. But in order to change the subject, he smiled gaily and turned toward the ladies. "Let us try now, Countess," he began. But Levin wanted to finish saying what he thought. "I think," he continued, "that this attempt of the spiritualists to explain their wonders by some kind of new force is most unsuccessful. They speak definitely of a spiritual force, and yet want to subject it to a material test." Everybody waited for him to finish, and he was conscious of it. "I think you would make a splendid medium," said the Countess Nordston. "There is something ecstatic about you." Levin opened his mouth to reply, but blushed and said nothing. "Let us try table-turning now, Princess Kitty. Please do," said Vronsky. "May we, Princess?" he said to her mother, and he rose and looked round for a suitable table. Kitty rose to fetch a table, and as she passed Levin, their eyes met. She pitied him with her whole soul, especially because she herself had caused him to suffer. "If you can forgive me, please do," pleaded her look. "I am so happy."
"I hate everybody, including you and myself," answered his eyes, and he took up his hat.
But he was not fated to go yet. Just as the others began settling round the table and Levin was about to go, the old prince came in, and having greeted the ladies, he turned to Levin.
"Ah," said he heartily, "been here long? I did not even know that you had arrived. Very glad to see you."
He embraced Levin, and speaking to him, did not catch sight of Vronsky, who rose and stood quietly waiting until the prince should notice him. Kitty was conscious that, after what had taken place, her father's cordiality oppressed Levin. She also noticed how coldly her father at last responded to Vronsky's bow, and with what good-natured perplexity Vronsky looked at him, trying but failing to understand how it was possible not to be friendly disposed toward him, and she blushed.
"Prince, release Mr. Levin for us, as we want to try an experiment," said the Countess Nordston.
"What experiment? Table-turning? Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, but in my opinion playing at Hunt the Ring is more amusing," said the old prince, looking at Vronsky and guessing that he had started the thing. "After all, there is some sense in hunting the ring."
Vronsky's unflinching eye glanced in astonishment at the old prince, and slightly smiling he at once began talking to the Countess Nordston about the ball that was to take place the next week.
"I hope you will be there," he said to Kitty.
As soon as the old prince had turned away from him, Levin went out unobserved, and his last impression was Kitty's happy, smiling face as she answered Vronsky's question about the ball.
Chapter 15. After the guests had gone, Kitty told her mother of her conversation with Levin, and in spite of all her pity for him, she was pleased by the thought that she had had a proposal. She did not doubt that she had acted rightly, yet for a long time she lay in bed, unable to sleep. One image pursued her relentlessly. It was Levin's face with his kind eyes looking mournfully from under his knit brows as he stood listening to her father and glancing at her and at Vronsky, and she felt so sorry for him that tears rose to her eyes. But she immediately remembered for whom she had exchanged him. She vividly pictured to herself that strong, manly face, that well-bred calm, and the kindness toward everybody he always showed. She remembered the love the man she loved bore her, and again became joyful, and with a happy smile put her head on her pillow. "It is a pity, a pity. But I'm not to blame," she said to herself. But an inner voice said something different. Whether she repented of having drawn Levin on or of having rejected him, she did not know, but her happiness was troubled by doubts.
"Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy," she repeated to herself till she fell asleep.
Meanwhile, below in the prince's little study, her parents were having one of their frequent scenes about their favourite daughter.
"What? I'll tell you what!"
shouted the prince, flourishing his arms and immediately again wrapping his squirrel-lined dressing-gown around him.
"You have no pride, no dignity. You disgrace and ruin your daughter by this vile, idiotic matchmaking."
"For goodness sake, prince, what in heaven's own name have I done?" said the princess, almost in tears. After her talk with her daughter, she had come in, happy and contented, to say good night to the prince, as usual, and though she did not intend to speak to him about Levin's proposal and Kitty's refusal, she hinted to him that she thought the matter with Vronsky was quite settled and would probably be definitely decided as soon as his mother arrived. And when she said that, the prince suddenly flared up and began to shout rudely,
"What have you done? Why, this! First of all, you entice a suitor. All Moscow will talk about it, and with reason. If you give a party, invite everybody, and not only selected suitors, invite all the young puppies," so the prince called the Moscow young men. "Have a pianist and let them dance. But don't have the sort of thing we had tonight. These suitors and this pairing off. It makes me sick to see it, simply sick. And you've had your way and have turned the child's head. Levin is 1,000 times the better man. This one is a little Petersburg fop. They are machine-made by the dozen, all to one pattern, and all mere rubbish. But even if he were a prince of the blood, my daughter does not need him."
"But what have I done?"
"Just this," exclaimed the prince angrily. "I know this much," the princess interrupted him, "that if I were to listen to what you say, we should never see our daughter married, and we'd better go and live in the country." "So we had."
"Wait a bit. Do I draw them on?" "No, certainly not. But a young man, and an excellent young man, falls in love with Kitty, and she too seems..."
"Seems indeed. And suppose she really falls in love with him while he intends to marry about as much as I do. Oh, I wish my eyes had never seen it. Ah, spiritualism. Ah, how nice. Ah, the ball.
And the prince, imagining himself to be impersonating his wife, curtsied at each word.
And then, if we really ruin Kitty's happiness, if she really gets it into her head...
But why do you suppose such a thing?
I don't suppose, I know. We have eyes for those things, and women haven't. I can recognise a man who has serious intentions, such as Levin, and I can see through a weathercock like that popinjay, who only wishes to amuse himself.
Oh, well, when you once get a thing into your head...
And you'll find it out, but too late, just as with poor Dolly.
All right, don't let's talk, said the princess, interrupting him and remembering the unfortunate Dolly.
Very well, then. Good night.
And having made the sign of the cross over one another and kissed, feeling that each of them retained their individual opinions, the couple separated for the night. The princess had been at first firmly convinced that this evening had decided Kitty's fate, and that there could be no doubt as to Vronsky's intentions. But her husband's words disturbed her, and when she reached her room, in terror of the uncertainty of the future, she mentally repeated, just as Kitty had done, "Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy." Chapter 16. Vronsky had never known family life. His mother in her youth had been a brilliant society woman, and during her married life, and especially in her widowhood, had had many love affairs known to everybody. He hardly remembered his father, and had been educated in the cadet corps. On leaving that corps, as a very young and brilliant officer, he at once joined the swim of the wealthy military Petersburg set. Though he occasionally went into the highest Petersburg society, all his love interests lay outside it. In Moscow, after this luxurious course of Petersburg life, he experienced for the first time the delight of intimacy with a sweet, innocent society girl who fell in love with him. It never entered his head that there could be any wrong in his relations with Kitty. At balls he danced chiefly with her, and he visited her at her home. He talked with her the usual society talk, all sorts of rubbish, but rubbish into which, involuntarily, he put a special meaning for her. Though he never said anything to her which could not have been said before everybody, he was conscious that she was becoming more and more dependent upon him, and the more he felt this, the pleasanter it was, and the more tender became his feelings towards her. He did not know that his behaviour toward Kitty had a name of its own, that it was decoying a girl with no intentions of marrying her, and is one of the evil actions common among brilliant young men like himself. He thought he was the first to discover this pleasure, and he enjoyed his discovery. If he could have heard what her parents said that night, if he could have known her family's point of view and learnt that Kitty would be unhappy if he did not marry her, he would have been much surprised and would not have believed it. He would not have believed that what gave so much and such excellent pleasure to him and, what was more, to her, could be wrong. Even less could he have believed that he ought to marry. Marriage had never presented itself to him as a possibility. Not only did he dislike family life, but in accordance with the views generally held in the bachelor world in which he lived, he regarded the family, and especially a husband, as something alien, hostile, and above all, ridiculous. But although Vronsky had no suspicion of what Kitty's parents were saying, he felt, as he left the Shcherbatskys' house that night, that the secret spiritual bond which existed between him and Kitty had so strengthened during the evening that some action ought to be taken. But what this should or could be, he could not imagine. "That's what is so delightful," he thought, as he left the Shcherbatskys' house, carrying away from there, as usual, a pleasant feeling of purity and freshness, partly due to the fact that he had not smoked at all that evening, and deeply touched by a new sense of tender joy in the consciousness of her love for him. "That is what is so delightful, that nothing was said either by me or by her. Yet we so well understand one another in that subtle language of looks and tones that today, more plainly than ever, she has told me that she loves me." and how sweetly, simply, and above all, trustfully. I feel myself better and purer. I feel I have a heart and that there is much that is good in me. Those dear, loving eyes, when she said, "And very much."
Well, and what of it? Nothing, of course. It's pleasant for me and for her.
And he considered where he should finish his evening. He passed in review the places he might go to.
The club? A game of bezique? A bottle of champagne with Ignatieff? No, I won't go there. Château des Fleurs. There I should find Oblonsky. French couplets? The can-can? Nah, I'm sick of it. That's just what I like about the Shabatskys, that I myself become better there. I'll go home.
He went straight to his rooms at the Hotel Dussot, had supper, and after undressing had hardly laid his head on his pillow before he was fast asleep.
Chapter 17. At 11 o'clock next morning, Vronsky drove to the Petersburg railway station in Moscow to meet his mother, and the first person he saw on the steps of the large portico was Oblonsky, who was expecting his sister by the same train.
"Hello, Your Excellency," exclaimed Oblonsky. "Whom are you after?"
"My mother," replied
Vronsky, shaking hands and smiling, as everybody did when meeting Oblonsky, as they went up the steps together.
"She's coming from Petersburg today."
"I waited for you till 2 last night. Where did you go from the Shabatskys?"
"Home," replied Vronsky.
"To tell you the truth, I felt in such a pleasant mood when I left the Shabatskys that I did not care to go anywhere else."
"Fiery steeds by something brands I can always recognize. Youths in love," declaimed Oblonsky, just as he had done to Levin.
Vronsky smiled with a look that seemed not to deny the implication, but he immediately changed the subject.
"And whom have you come to meet?" he asked.
"I? A lovely woman," answered Oblonsky.
"Dear me. On y soit qui mal y pense. My sister, Anna."
"Oh, Mrs. Karenina," said Vronsky.
"I expect you know her?"
"I think I do, but perhaps not. I really can't remember," answered Vronsky, absent-mindedly, the name Karenina suggesting to him someone stiff and dull.
"But you're sure to know Alexis Alexandrovich Karenin, my famous brother-in-law. All the world knows him."
"Oh, yes, I know him by repute and by sight. I know he's clever, learned, and by way of being religious, but you know it is not my... not in my line," he added in English.
"Oh, yes. He's a very remarkable man. A bit conservative, but a splendid fellow," said Oblonsky. "A splendid fellow."
"Well, so much the better for him," and Vronsky smiled.
"Ah, you're here," he went on, turning toward his mother's old footman, who was standing by the door. "Come in here."
Besides liking Oblonsky, as everybody did, Vronsky latterly had felt still more drawn to him because he was connected in his mind with Kitty.
"Well, are we to give a supper to the diva next Sunday?" he asked, smilingly, taking Oblonsky's arm.
"Certainly. I will collect subscriptions. I say, did you make the acquaintance of my friend Levin last night?" asked Oblonsky.
"Of course. Only he left very early."
"He's a splendid fellow," continued Oblonsky.
"Don't you think so?"
"I don't know how it is that all Muscovites, present company, of course, excepted," Vronsky put in jokingly, "are so abrupt. They're always standing on their hind legs, getting angry, and seem to want to act on your feelings."
"Yes, there's some truth in that," said Oblonsky, laughing merrily.
"Shall we have to wait much longer?" asked Vronsky, turning to a porter.
The train is signalled," said the porter.
The approach of the train was made more and more evident by the increasing bustle and preparation on the platform and the arrival of people who had come to meet the train. Through the frosty mist one could see workmen in sheepskin coats and felt boots crossing the curved railway lines, and hear the whistle of a locomotive and the noisy movements of a heavy mass.
No, said Oblonsky, who was anxious to tell Vronsky about Levin's intentions concerning Kitty. No, you have not judged my Levin rightly. He is a very nervous man, and does make himself unpleasant sometimes, that's true enough, but on the other hand, he's sometimes very charming. His is such an honest, straightforward nature, and he has a heart of gold. But yesterday there were special reasons, continued Oblonsky with a significant smile, quite forgetting the sincere sympathy he had felt for his friend the day before, and now only feeling the same sympathy for Vronsky. Yes, there was a reason why he had to be either specially happy or specially unhappy. Vronsky stopped and asked him straight out, What do you mean? Did he propose to your belle sœur last night? Perhaps, said Oblonsky. I seemed to notice something of the kind yesterday. Oh, yes, if he left early and was in a bad temper, it must be that. He's been in love with her so long, and I'm very sorry for him.
Dear me. But I should think she may make a better match, said Vronsky.
And expanding his chest, he again moved forward. However, I don't know him, he added.
Yes, it is a painful position. That is why so many prefer women of the demi-monde. If you don't succeed in that case, it only shows that you've not enough money. But in this case, one's pride is in the balance. But here's the train.
In fact, the engine was already whistling in the distance, and a few moments later the platform shook as the train puffed in. The steam spread low in the frozen air, the connecting rods slowly and rhythmically pushed and pulled. The bent figure of the engine driver, warmly wrapped up, was seen covered with hoarfrost. The engine, with the tender behind it, moved slowly into the station, gradually slowing down and making the platform tremble still more. Then came the luggage van in which a dog was whining, and at last the passenger coaches oscillating before they stopped. The sprightly guard blew his whistle and jumped off while the train was still moving, and impatient passengers began to descend one after another. An officer of the guards, erect and looking sternly round, a fidgety little tradesman with a bag, a peasant with a sack over his shoulder. Vronsky, as he stood by Oblonsky and watched these passengers coming out of the carriages, quite forgot about his mother. What he had just heard about Kitty excited and delighted him. His chest involuntarily expanded, and his eyes shone. He felt himself to be a conqueror.
"The Countess Vronsky is in that compartment," said the sprightly guard, addressing Vronsky.
His words roused Vronsky from his reverie and reminded him of his mother and of the coming meeting. In the depths of his heart he did not respect his mother, and, though this he never acknowledged to himself, did not love her. But in accordance with the views of the set he lived in, and as a result of his education, he could not imagine himself treating her in any way but one altogether submissive and respectful. The more submissive and respectful he was externally, the less he honoured and loved her in his heart.
Chapter 18. Vronsky followed the guard to the carriage and had to stop at the entrance of the compartment to let a lady pass out. The trained insight of a society man enabled Vronsky with a single glance to decide that she belonged to the best society. He apologized for being in her way and was about to enter the carriage, but felt compelled to have another look at her, not because she was very beautiful, nor because of the elegance and modest grace of her whole figure, but because he saw in her sweet face as she passed him something specially tender and kind. When he looked round, she too turned her head. Her bright grey eyes, which seemed dark because of their black lashes, rested for a moment on his face as if recognizing him, and then turned to the passing crowd, evidently in search of someone. In that short look, Vronsky had time to notice the subdued animation that enlivened her face, and seemed to flutter between her bright eyes and a scarcely perceptible smile which curved her rosy lips. It was as if an excess of vitality so filled her whole being that it betrayed itself against her will, now in her smile, now in the light of her eyes. She deliberately tried to extinguish that light in her eyes, but it shone, despite of her, in her faint smile. Vronsky entered the carriage. His mother, a thin old woman with black eyes and curled hair, screwed up her eyes as she recognized her son, and her thin lips smiled slightly. She rose from the seat, and giving her handbag to her maid, held out her small, dry hand to her son. Then, lifting his head, which had been bent to kiss her hand, kissed him on his face.
"You had my telegram? You're well? That's a good thing."
"Have you had a good journey?" asked her son, sitting down on the seat beside her and involuntarily listening to a woman's voice outside the door. He knew it was the voice of the lady he had met as he entered the carriage.
"All the same, I don't agree with you," the lady was saying.
"Yours are Petersburg views, madame."
"Oh, not at all. Simply a woman's views."
"Well, allow me to kiss your hand."
"Au revoir, Ivan Petrovich. And please, if you see my brother, send him to me," said the lady, closing the door and again entering the compartment.
"Well, have you found your brother?"
asked Vronsky's mother, addressing the lady. Vronsky understood now that this was Mrs. Karenina.
"Your brother is here," he said, rising. "Excuse my not recognizing you before. Our acquaintance was so slight," he said with a bow, "that I am sure you do not remember me."
"Oh, yes, I should have recognized you, especially as I believe your mother and I have talked of nothing but you all the way," said she, at last allowing the animation she had been trying to suppress to reveal itself in a smile.
"But my brother is not here yet."
"Go and call him, Alexei," said the old countess. Vronsky went out onto the platform and shouted, "Oblonsky! Here!" Mrs. Karenina did not wait for her brother to come in, but on seeing him descended from the carriage with a firm, light step. As soon as her brother came up to her, she threw her left arm round his neck with a movement that struck Vronsky by its firmness and grace, and drawing him to herself, gave him a vigorous kiss. Vronsky did not take his eyes off her, and kept smiling, he knew not why. But remembering that his mother was waiting for him, he went back into the carriage.
"She's very charming, isn't she?" said the Countess, referring to Mrs. Karenina. "Her husband put her into the compartment with me, and I was very pleased. We talked all the way. And you, I hear, vous filez le parfait amour? Tant mieux, mon cher, tant mieux."
"I don't know what you mean, maman," the son replied coldly.
"Well, shall we go?"
Mrs. Karenina again entered the carriage to take leave of the Countess. "There, Countess, you have met your son, and I my brother," she said, "and I have exhausted my stock of stories and should have had nothing more to tell you."
"Oh, no, no," said the Countess, holding her hand. "I could travel round the world with you and not be dull. You are one of those charming women with whom it is nice to talk and nice to be silent. But please don't fret about your son. You can't expect never to be parted."
Mrs. Karenina stood very erect, and her eyes were smiling. "Anna Arkadyevna Karenina has a son who, I think, is 8 years old," explained the Countess, "and she has never before been separated from him, and so she is worried at having left him."
"Yes, the Countess and I have talked all the time, I about my son and she about hers," said Mrs. Karenina, and a smile brightened her face, a kind smile on his account.
"I expect you got very weary of it," he said, quickly seizing in its flight the ball of coquetry she had thrown at him. But she evidently did not wish to continue the conversation in that tone, and turned to the old Countess.
"Oh, thank you very much. I hardly noticed how the time passed. Au revoir, Countess."
"Goodbye, dear," answered the Countess. "Let me kiss your pretty face. I'm an old woman, and say what I mean, and tell you frankly that I've lost my heart to you."
Conventional as the phrase was, Mrs. Karenina evidently believed it and was pleased. She blushed, stooped a little, and held out her face for the Countess to kiss. Then she stood up again and, with the same smile hovering between her lips and eyes, held out her hand to Vronsky. He pressed the little hand, and the firm grip with which she shook his gave him unusual pleasure. She went out with that brisk tread which carried her rather full figure with such wonderful ease.
"Very charming," said the old lady.
Her son thought so too. He followed her with his eyes as long as he could see her graceful form, and his face retained its smile. Through the carriage window he saw her approach her brother and speak to him with animation about something that evidently had no connection with him, Vronsky, and that seemed to him provoking.
"Well, maman, are you quite well?"
he said, turning toward his mother.
"Quite. Everything is all right. Alexander was very nice, and Varya looks very handsome. She is most interesting."
And she began to tell about what interested her most, her grandson's christening, for which she had gone to Petersburg, and the special favour the Emperor had shown to her eldest son.
"Here is Lavrenti at last," said Vronsky, looking out of the window. "We can go now, if you like."
The old majordomo, who had accompanied the Countess on her journey, came in and announced that everything was ready, and the Countess rose to go.
"Come, there's not much of a crowd now," said Vronsky.
The maid took one bag and the little dog, the majordomo and the porter took the other bags. Vronsky gave his arm to his mother, but just as they were coming out of the carriage, several people ran past them with frightened faces. The station master, with his peculiar coloured cap, also ran past them. Evidently something unusual had happened. The people were running back from the train.
"What? What? Where? Thrown himself under! Run over!"
shouted the passers-by. Oblonsky, with his sister on his arm, also turned back, and, avoiding the crowd, stood with frightened faces beside the carriage. The ladies re-entered the carriage, while Vronsky and Oblonsky followed the crowd to find out about the accident. A watchman, either tipsy or too much muffled up because of the severe frost, had not heard a train that was being shunted and had been run over. Before Vronsky and Oblonsky returned, the ladies had heard this from the majordomo. Oblonsky and Vronsky had both seen the mangled corpse. Oblonsky was evidently suffering. His face was puckered, and he seemed ready to cry.
"Oh, how terrible! Oh, Anna, if you had seen it! Oh, how terrible!"
he kept saying. Vronsky remained silent. His handsome face was serious, but perfectly calm.
"Oh, if you had seen it, Countess," said Oblonsky. "And his wife was there. It was dreadful to see her. She threw herself on the body. They say he was the sole support of a very large family. It is terrible."
"Can nothing be done for her?" said Mrs. Karenina in an agitated whisper.
Vronsky glanced at her and at once went out.
"I will be back directly, maman," he added, turning at the doorway.
When he returned a few minutes later, Oblonsky was already talking to the Countess about the new opera singer, while she was impatiently glancing at the door in expectation of her son.
"Now let's go," said Vronsky as he came in.
They went together, Vronsky walking in front with his mother, Mrs. Karenina following with her brother. At the exit, the station master overtook them and said to Vronsky,
"You gave my assistant 200 roubles. Please be so kind as to say whom you intended it for."
"For the widow,"
said Vronsky, shrugging his shoulders. "I don't understand what need there is to ask."
"You have given it?"
exclaimed Oblonsky behind Vronsky, and pressing his sister's arm, he added,
"Very kind. Very kind. Isn't he a fine fellow?
My respects to you, Countess."
And he remained behind with his sister, seeking her maid. When they came out, the Vronsky's carriage had already started. The people coming from the station were still talking about the accident.
"What a terrible death,"
said some gentleman as he passed them.
Cut in half, I hear. On the contrary, I think it is a very easy death, instantaneous, said another.
How is it that precautions are not taken? Said a third.
Mrs. Karenina got into her brother's carriage, and Oblonsky noticed with surprise that her lips were trembling, and that it was with difficulty she kept back her tears.
What is the matter?